if you are able to open a way, then you may have some advantages. But as far, apparently, as far as not many other women are on that way, you understand what I mean? So one of the things that I am sure is making feminism and women's rights not go so fast is that in politics, in the university also, women that reach a point are very jealous of what they reach. And they used to close the door to other women.
On the other women.
On the other women. But this is not a thing conscious. It's a thing unconscious. Because it has been so hard that you want to conserve the small piece you have. And sometimes you forget that if you share your piece with another, you are going to have not two pieces but three pieces. So, this, we the politics, we are not better than the other people, for sure. So, what happened is that I'm explaining now very sincerely what happened. In the Senate, maybe because the pressure, political pressure is not so strong, I think they are about 18 women, they are very close. Maybe because the Camera of the Senate in Spain has not such a direct power as it has the Congress. You understand what I'm talking about? And in the Congress, to tell you the truth, I am working with, let's say, I think we are 7 or 8 working very close together, but we were not able to bring up to us to the some of them, not all, but some of them. And one thing, in spite of that, there is something very interesting also to know, that there is a big solidarity between women inside the Congress, even if we are not of the same political group. This is quite interesting. For instance, to tell you the truth, and just in private also, women from parties more to the right than we are very good friends together. And for instance, one of them on the very right side, at the very right, has two, now just from 1 week they have 3 women, congresswomen. But until now, because she came last week, because one of the men came to the European community, you understand? He came as a minister in the European community, and then came a woman, to make the situation. Okay. But with two of them, for instance, one of them is a woman, the party said to vote against divorce. And she was feeling very bad. Because what happened to women is that the real experience, one thing is when they tell you to think or not, but the real experience modified lots of things. That woman has been, this is the real history, she's married to a man who was a correspondent of a Spanish newspaper in the United States, and that was, he was married before to an American woman. So he's divorced, and then he married her. You understand? So she was not able to vote against the boss because it's his whole history, you understand? That day she didn't come to the parliament. Another thing, but she was very pressed because of the party. Another thing, when we decide abortion, the other one, said, I am in hope. Or I come push and say yes, because my party is going to name me, and, you know, sack the leader. I'm telling you that because In some things, I wouldn't say that maybe they are the exception, I don't know. We don't have more women on the right than we don't know if the other ones are like that. But to tell you the truth, is that to work with that woman is not difficult. And often, we collaborate together in a sense of women's rights. And we, for instance, with one of them, I have been member of the what we call the International Parliamentary Union. And we have came together, and we even silenced, we have shared part of our intervention. You say this because it's better. If you said, say this too, because I can say because of my partner. I say, you understand a little bit? And we make a little bit of lobbyistic thing. Not very much, because really we are not very experienced yet. But we were together. Sorry, I was longer.
No, but the reason why I was asking, why I asked you that is because I work in the New York State Legislature, and I will say that the women politicians, they are not at all together. They do not have an agenda. And the same thing is happening that is happening in Spain. That if their party says, we are interested in this issue, they have to vote that way. Otherwise, forget it. And that goes for Republicans and Democrats.
But they do something. For instance, I know Mrs. Burks. She's from the South. She's from New Orleans. And I visited her in Washington too, in the office and so on. And then they have a newspaper, and they made a newspaper with some congresswoman. I mean, maybe not the 100%, but they do things. They do things together. Of course, there is limitations,
right?
I know.
That's also
at
the national level.
I wanted to say, because I guess we're just going around. There are a number of us here who actually have written books about Spain, and we know Mary's work very well. And a question is, I'm interested in the way you, the historical picture you gave, because we're very familiar with the over 14 books of Lydia Falcón and the Feminist Party, and I wonder, you know, if you would mention that. And also, the books that we read over the years were Maria Aurelia Capmany, in other words, and you know, Lydia and even Campo Alange had, I mean, there are so many women who did do those original groundbreaking books, and I wondered if you were just focusing history, because it seems that these women were doing interdisciplinary work and throwing their gotas year after year for the last 20 years, and it seems the names you mentioned, I'm not familiar with them at all, maybe Lourdes is, or Liz, those names, Pilar, you said she didn't publish, but I'm wondering about just, you know, mentioning the work of somebody like Lydia Falcón. I don't know.
She called me also, and I didn't say anything.
Right,
but she has a picture of me, and she maybe doesn't like me.
And Maria José Rage and something like Vindicación Feminista, which you can get those over 2-3 years of the only organ publishing incredible feminist material. I just wondered about
your... I tell you something, I become a feminist because there's something you have inside, and you are in disagreement with something, and one day you find somebody explains in a book what happens to you. And I'll tell you, I feel that when I was reading a book of Lydia Falcón, and after with another one in Maria Aurelia Capmany. And on that day, I find not so much, well, they are writing and they say what I'm feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. I mean, even if now, by now, I don't agree as much as Lydia Falcón of the development she has made.
Mm-hmm.
I myself, I my friend when I spoke with me, that I owe her to, you know, to become touched. And that's a very good thing, if you become touched.
Yes, absolutely. I wondered how you could, in 20 years, of the only person writing, and writing on a level which was before, before any of the French feminists, at the par with the American feminists, not even knowing about them, and the only theoretician. I think the unfortunate thing for Spain is that the works aren't translated into English, so therefore the French feminists have all
the works. I mean, how was her work even accepted in Spain? Who were the publishers?
The problem is that there are a long, long, long list of works that, you know, I could spend the evening talking about, but they have not been published. So the feeling I get from Spain is that where the English-speaking audience is concerned, that there is probably much more knowledge about what's been happening in Italy or France to what's been happening in Spain.
Is there a woman's publishing company?
There is a woman's publishing company that is surviving with difficulty, but has, for example, published recuperated older texts. You know, and republish them, yes, indeed. And in fact, I had a quote, but obviously you always think out more and actually, you know, switch around when you're talking. But what I was going to say is that although we haven't had professional historians like Mary Beard, as you would have had in the United States, we did have people like Maria Campo Alange, like Maria Aurelia Capmany, who dealt with historical issues at a time when nobody else was doing them, and also to a large degree in the 1960s and early 70s, outside the university, were dealing with these issues, and to a very large degree did help to open up this long process of recuperating our collective memory, of getting out of the amnesia that everybody had gone through, at least openly and publicly, with respect to women, and also obviously with respect to the whole political situation prior to the Franco regime. Then within the actual, I mean, I was dealing with women's studies, women's history within, if you like, the university field. What I could say is not only just to win of authors like you mentioned, but for example, what's very important as well, although it hasn't had probably the constancy, the continuation, is that there is one particular center for feminist documentation that held this wonderful exhibition in Madrid on women and work. So that there has been both inside and outside the university, different initiatives have been going on. But probably where actually research is concerned, that came on more within the university circles, since the mid-70s, the period I've been dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, well, of course, another matter, a whole issue would be to deal with the development of actually present-day feminism, theory on feminism, which would be what the kind of thing Lydia Falcón and many others have been talking about, discussing, and the whole development of the actual feminist movement in Spain. There is a book by Amparo Moreno which might be useful, which mm-hmm. is a history of the development of the feminist movement in Spain from the mid-70s, which, you know, it has not been translated either, but would give you an idea of the actual development of the movement and the kind of people mm-hmm. involved and what the issues were.
Well, all of the areas around what you're calling historiography interest me, because since I worked on Spanish history and wrote on a figure that I consider to be what we would say here the foremother, and since you're talking about the public sphere, the focus on the public sphere, I wrote on Carmen de Burgos, and who died in 1932. And who was one of the first people to do a survey on divorce, who struggled for women's rights, who wrote about women's topics. But what my concern has been in still trying to pursue the threads that I feel I haven't been able to get out about her are areas around what I know to have been progressive women's activity prior to Franco, but even given the context of today's more progressive situation, and of course many of these women are very old, but let's say I was doing my investigations in the 70s, mid-70s, were still not able to open up to give me their connection to their progressive past, and they were not doing that, and what I see is that many of them have gotten lost. And so I'm concerned that, for example, I think that she is a thread that really requires a lot more study, since she has a book that analyzes the social situation of women in the world that she published, I'm always repeating this, about way before Simone de Beauvoir, and yes, of course, we can say more and more, or over and over, that it's the problem of Spanish and the English-speaking public not knowing Spanish, and etc. Nevertheless, what I also find, however, is that there is a certain amount of interest on the part of those who are doing research into feminism in Spain, on Spaniards who are doing that, but who somehow haven't made those connections. I know there's one master's thesis, perhaps, or one, you know, that has gotten interested in her, but that there was a whole area of women around her in the Lyceum Club, for example, in Madrid, that seems to me...
What
she lived 1869 to 1932, and all around that area, there were she talks about the various kinds of feminisms, you know, the sort of religious feminism she talks about, and the public feminism, and the sort of liberal feminism, and she's done all kinds of analysis. All right, but so around her epoch, and women who lived later, because she died medium young, who lived after the Civil War and that were still alive in the 70s, were not as, unfortunately for me, forthcoming. But I know that there are certain things that still exist that it seems to me would be a very fruitful way to go into that. And I don't know, you know, are there people in the universities that are perhaps looking at that?
Well, there's just been a recent dissertation on the development of the rise of feminism in Spain, which has quite an important chapter on Carmen de Burgos by Concha Fagoaga, which is the voice and vote of women. It's been published by Icaria. So there are people working in and around that, but there are, you know, that's virgin territory to a large degree. And also, I mean, what I didn't mention is the enormous difficulties we have in dealing with any kind of women's history, contemporary women's history in Spain, because of the sources. The utter, total disapparition, they totally disappear. You know, anything to do with issues in the 30s are very difficult to get your hands on. You know, for example, whole blocks of records of the different ministries have totally disappeared. They are very dispersed. You may find them in what had been the police archives in Salamanca. They may be in Amsterdam. And there's absolutely no guarantee that you can build up a full record. So it's much easier from British, US, even French or Italian history to reconstruct, because you actually have data to work on. Part of our major work is being detectives and actually trying to locate things. And also the difficulty you mentioned is major. And if you were trying to work in the early 70s, there are reticence to speak about any issue because of the political, the fear, which indeed, in fact, has continued quite a lot nowadays. There is a general, it's not that easy to go out, if you want to speak to people who are not major political figures, but want to speak to ordinary people, it's very difficult to link up, connect, and have them willing to talk to you. So that one means a very important degree of networking. And I don't know of this in Madrid, where Carmen de Burgos and the late 20s and early 30s is concerned. Well, yes, there is a thesis being written on Madrid, women in Madrid, for the 1920s. It's a dissertation, a PhD dissertation, which is, you know, being written up. And where the Civil War period is concerned, there is an important oral history project going on as well, as there is in Barcelona. There has been this attempt to reach a maximum amount of women and to, you know, develop oral history sources. Now, this has been going on, but of course, you know, in the center in Barcelona, we have about 60. About 60 oral histories already done there, life histories. But the problem is financing. I mean, the center in Barcelona does not have a budget. So every single initiative you've got to go and beg and scrounge, etc., etc., for some money to be able to carry out initiatives. And that is all over.
Does the government provide the money?
No, the government does not provide the money. It's, not normally private money, because that's quite a different situation from here, in the sense that there is not the custom of private funding that you do get here. We don't have our Ford Foundation or our Rockefeller Foundation. The law has just changed very recently, just in the past few months, so we would hope at some stage to be able to avail of that. So in fact, a lot of funding has come via university, via public institutions, via the municipality, via the Institute for Women in Madrid, etc., etc. But these are, you know, it's what is extremely difficult to do is to plan things ahead so as to be able to have these ongoing projects. And the problem here is that time is running out. These people are now in 70s, late 70s, of course, they only have a certain amount of, and then actually the difficulties in working also with memory of older people again is quite problematical. But what we need is, and that is one of the reasons why one of our first tasks was the development of this bibliography, because we found amazing things, which reflects the actual situation of the libraries and their functioning, because they're badly catalogued. So for example, under the term military, we found over 60 references dealing with women. So, you know, it's very, very, the general research situation presents major difficulties which a historian or sociologist would not probably have in this country, as far as my knowledge is. So there are people working on this quite definitely, and more so all the time. So it is to be hoped that, you know, that we will eventually come up with a a fairly good picture, but the picture will always be incomplete because of this, you know, tremendous problem of sources.
The only problem I see in that is that we are now in the border to lose an opportunity not to look for papers that have been lost, but to make a little bit of oral history. I mean, the people, in one part of the history you could just reproduce if you don't have the papers. You just talk with the people. And, you know, we are on the border of people that is getting, is dying now.
Yeah, they all started dying on me. One after
that's the thing. And I tell you, well, just one experience, because when you cannot find out, by the way of investigation, right now, it is 1 year ago, what happened, it was a signal of what I'm saying. One girl, some girls for the first time, wanted to become miners. I don't know, you know,
miners.
And the result of that, it was of the mine didn't want to contract them because, you know, it was a strong tradition about trade unions, and especially because the relation, labor relation in the miners, it is that if you are a son of a miner, you are a better opportunity to get, especially if the miner became ill because of the work in the miner, or ill if he died. So, to put up girls in this, you know, the men were against, and there was a very mixed thing. And one of the reasons they said there had never a woman working in the mines.
Is that true?
This appeared in the newspaper. And in 15 days, appeared a woman that now it's 84. And she said, during the war, I was working in the mine, and I was not the only one.
Well, one of the stories that this woman has written about talks about the description of women and children working in the mines.
So I think, how can we, I mean, we are going to forget even the reality if we don't find a way to reproduce our history, especially in this period, or even if it is from the way of oral history, really, it's a very pity because the opportunity is just closing now because people is getting very old and they're dying.
So again, we need, you know, more resources and more funding so as to be able to do so.
This is a very different subject. Mm-hmm. And it's related to the issue that Anna brought up about this country being the center of being the imperial, the empire.
Yeah.
And the smaller countries out there not being able to do anything. Well, I think that's true. I mean, I couldn't agree more. But at the same time, I think the smaller countries out there can do something. And I thought, some of us thought that Spain had the historical opportunity last week to vote against the military blocs. And the opportunity was lost. And I would like to ask Anna, as a politician, as a member of a party that was against Spain being a member of NATO first and then changed its mind. And also to Mary, as a, you know, feminist in academia, whether there is a feminist position or there wasn't, what is your own view of what happened?
Well, this is something that has caused me even become a little ill. It's the only time in my life, Mary knows it, that I did in politics something that was against my heart. And tell you something, not against my mind. Because if it had been against my mind, I wouldn't have, not both, I made the campaign too. I'll tell you something, if you really have the numbers, and if you really have the things on you, you should realize, at least that was what I was convinced, the difficulties of saying no to that referendum. There is one first thing. The first thing is that this referendum has upset the whole country. That's the first thing. Because the ones that were against, we, make campaign to get in, but to remain in NATO. And the ones that wanted to be in NATO, not only political, but military too, they make campaign to go out, you understand? So the whole country has become a little bit like that, and a little bit paranoid. This is true. And because of that, I mean, the left, I'm going to explain very quickly. We were in NATO already. First thing, we are in NATO already since 4 years, nearly 5 years.
We are not in NATO, and what we say, the military order of NATO, but yes, in the political order of NATO. And the referendum was to decide if we keep in the political part of the NATO, or if we go out of the NATO. That's the referendum. Usually, right, my country was saying that it was not enough to be in the political side of NATO, that we should get just full inside and get also in the military. And once left, let's say, left communism and also the feeling of some of the people of the Socialist Party think that we should go out also of the political side. This has been really a very strange referendum, because to tell you the truth, and this is just to tell you the truth, we thought that this referendum was going to be win with the votes of the right. You understand? So, lots of people that vote socialists could vote no, you understand? Because the whole right was going to say yes. You understand the rest? What happened in this referendum, it's quite complicated, but I think you get it. What happened in this referendum is, I mean, we had the compromise. I'm just telling the truth. I mean, we had the compromise to make a referendum. And as far as we are in government, we haven't seen the difficulties to go out of the political act. Okay, the political. So, as we had the compromise, our government said, well, we make the referendum. And they count, the ones that are in favor are going to say yes. And on the left, some are going to say yes and some not, but the result is going to win. But what happened is that the right decide to make campaign against, because they realized the only way to make an difficult position was to vote no. So we had to make what we say, comes to the tripas corazón, and some that we should prefer not to have to make the campaign, and yes, I will have voted yes, because I'm going to explain you some of the reasons, but not to be on the street with that thing that just make us sick, especially it makes me sick really as a woman and as a feminist. No, we were so mixed up that I had to go to the hospital, I tell you the truth, the only time of my life, because it was so against my feelings. It's the only reason I'm fine. So, what happened in this? Well, I'm going to just to tell you something. From the 1985, since we came since we were getting inside the common market, and we got $3,000,000,000 investment, foreign investment in my country. $3,000,000,000 in 1985. A lot of multinational are coming in, and a lot of investment from foreign money. From this investment, and 90% is American money. I mean, not especially from the United States, but it's from the United States and from, you know, the multinationals. That's one of the things. We had signed plans to industrialize in new technology at least 80 new industries coming down to Spain to settle and, you know, just to develop there and so on. And one of the things, this is maybe one of the small reasons, but one of the things that we were very afraid of the international bloc if we leave NATO. And this international economic bloc, it's not a problem like Cuba that they say they don't. No. It's a problem of, you know, just not to invest so much in our country and to stop the investment and the things. And this thing, we were afraid, not as much as the United States, because you know, this campaign has also had the point of view very, very mixed up. The campaign was the USA wanted us to be in it. The USA, I really think, they don't mind so much because we have a bilateral trade with the United States. If we leave the NATO, what that means is that our bases in Spain are only going to be used for the Americans. This is what it means. the Germans and the French and the Italian, they are not going to use them. But you, the Americans, we have a bilateral agreement that finished in 1988. So, to tell you the truth, we found, I mean, we the socialists found, that if we can really keep outside of the military arc, if we can really keep out of nuclearizing the territory, once we were already in the political part of the NATO, once we were in, because we had to decide to go or not, I mean the decision was not to go in, but once we were in, the best thing was not to go out now, not to afford the consequences. And also, if we get in NATO, to try to negotiate another sort of bilateral thing with the United States, smaller one, because so we are already with the, you know, with the European countries. I think this is one of the reasons. I mean, recently, if you think about, I mean, if, as far as we thought about it, we think that the best thing. But I agree with you that what sometimes we want to do is to say, I'm going to say no to see what happened. To see what happened. Maybe small countries can say no. Alan Garcia in Peru said no. Maybe he's going to pay also. I don't know what will happen. I won't know what will happen. Sometimes it's easier for a liberal saying no than for a socialist saying no. Because what it says, you have already the bad reputation on that sense. And you must demonstrate you are a good boy. If you are more in the right, you can maybe do something like they are doing Alfonsín and Alan Garcia in South America. And if this should be done for Nicaragua, for let's say, something will explode in the world. Well, it's not a problem with Nicaragua because they don't get money to go back. But anyway, yes, you may write. For us, it's very difficult to understand because we have been always, we have been geographically in Europe, but we have not had the problems as the, we have not lived the same history as Europe. In the recent years, as far as we were not in the First and in the Second War, we were not. And so it seems we were neutral in the last war, it seems, because it was not really so, but it seems we play another thing. And we are in the corner of Europe, and we don't feel the pressure of the East as, for instance, Germany feels. So that thing really makes very difficult for we, the Spanish, to find the necessity to be in the NATO. But I think I told you what I really believe.
If you underestimate the impact of that anti-NATO movement in Spain, beyond the political alignment, I think that's why Germany was concerned about the vote in NATO, because that's where one of the strongest anti-NATO movements was in Europe.
Wait, yeah, right. The study is not que está subestimando.
En Alemania la posibilidad de que los alemanes estaban presionando tanto porque ellos en realidad veían la oposición española.
Un problema similar, ¿no?
There is something must not be. Oh, wow, you may be right. Sorry.
No, eso es lo que ella dijo. Do you want to have a... No, she didn't say. You have to talk louder. You are talking quietly.
There is only one thing.
No. Encara está de hacer la pregunta, cara.
Ya viene la pregunta.
Or for both of you, whoever wants to answer. Okay. I too am very interested in history, but I'm not my training is sort of in the field of academia. I'm interested, though, in what you were saying about recovering the history of the 1930s in the period of the Civil War. And you were speaking of it in terms of a problem of recovery and finding it, or, you know, perhaps publishing it or making it accessible. I'm interested in asking you both as feminists, though, how would you project that
experience into the contemporary reality.
That's my question.
A woman's movement that started out, you know, with such a fresh beginning. And again, I think that there's people underestimating, you know, what was really about in the United States or something like that. I mean, coming right out from under, you know, the period of Franco and having such a high consciousness. So I think of history as not in the past or we had the right to divorce then and it was taken away, or we had the right abortion. But that I think that maybe there was an idea that women who participated in the 1930s were trying to change social relations, something different in relations with men, family, at work, etc. How do you project that today, 1986?
That was also my question.
Not just as a center that some people, but as part of ongoing involvement.
Right.
And just as an aside, you feel you're compared to Italy and France. What about Portugal? Did that have any influence on Spain? I frankly feel in many ways what the women were able to do in Portugal for only, you know, maybe they had, you know, a very short time on the historical stage in the mid-70s, but what they presented to the world, I thought was tremendous. The new Portuguese letters and literature, felt like that was a very new creation of women's culture. The whole idea of non-partyism, of not going that route of political parties in order to try to influence change, a relationship of professional women to working class women that was not hierarchical or elitist, but very, very organic in each one from the other.
I wanted to make a comment first before you started, she said.
It was internal, and I think, I would just like to talk less about history for history's sake, but history for our sake.
Just a very small thing to say. I don't take importance to the European movement anti-nuclear, but no country in Europe is against NATO. There is not a movement against NATO. What happened is that the movement against nuclearization of the territory. That's the thing. And we don't have nuclear weapons in our country at all. And our referendum was not to have it. What I'm trying to say is that the big difference is that in Europe, in Germany, in all this concentration they made not because they want to go out of NATO, but what they don't want is to have nuclear weapons in the territory. I am sure they would very glad to be at least as our conditions are now, because we don't have nuclear weapons, and the condition not to go out was not to have it. And what we hope, I tell you the truth, that we hope is that one day we lose elections, that there is not going to be possible to nuclearize the territory if the right doesn't make another referendum to change that decision, you understand? This is the hope we have. That's
right. I think it's very important for us to know what the collective historical experience of women was. And obviously that affects our present day vision of it as well. But first of all, I think that in Spain we have, as historians, a task to pursue, which is to develop projects of research to get to know about what actually happened. And the more we do so, I think what we are finding is that the victimization interpretation of women no longer quite fits in. I mean, if you take the situation of an ongoing patriarchal discourse on women based on domesticity, based on the cult of motherhood, based on the separation of the spheres, and again based not just on secular arguments but on the pervasive institution of the Catholic Church, the situation from which one begins to contemplate women in the past is, I think, a very negative one, because this has been the general projection given on the situation of women. Now, when we begin to discover somewhat more about the actual situation of women in the ongoing historical process in Spain, we discover that, and I think that is important because it is a discovery to a large degree, in the sense that there wasn't a sensitivity on these issues, that women have been agents of change, that women have not just been the marionettes in the hands of the Catholic Church, that the image of women, the topic presented, but it's a constant topic presented of Spanish women as being politically conservative and also very religiously constrained, begins to be broken down. So if you discover that in 1835 the women in Barcelona were out on the streets building up barricades and forbidden to actually go out onto the street by the civil governor, who said that if they would do so they would be considered as public women, prostitutes, I think we're getting very interesting information which does show that women get involved in collective action, in social conflicts, but perhaps not exactly on the same issues and with the same motivation or in the same way as men does. And I think that has a direct implication to an understanding of the present day situation of women. In other words, what we find the more we delve into women's collective historical experience in Spain is that they were actors, that they were present, and they were not necessarily a conservative political force. At times they were, but the question is why and how and for what reasons? Not because they are these non-thinking robots, but probably or perhaps because the left did not correspond to their necessities. In other words, for me, the issues, the important thing is not the data, but we need the empirical data, otherwise we're doing history fiction, not historical analysis. But what I think are important and relevant for the present day are the questions we ask of the past, which are also questions we ask about the present. So that if you analyze, for example, the period of the Civil War, which is also, at least for some sectors within Spanish society, a period of social transformation and social change, if you also ask yourself, what did that imply with respect to patriarchal structures, if you develop a gender analysis and want to find out whether that actually also meant a redefinition of male-female relations, I think you are applying a kind of analysis to the past, which is very relevant also to the present. Apart from the fact that I think the actual discovery that we have a past and an ongoing past and not just a negative past is very important. Given, of course, the different political trajectory in Spain where there was this attempt to blackout, that does not mean to say that there was a total amnesia, but figures like Carmen de Burgos or others for the younger generations were not necessarily well known. For those who had lived those times, yes, they were. They might have been home figures, but there was not necessarily a public projection of them. Or take the issue you mentioned of abortion. The fact that we can analyze the legalization of abortion in 1936 in Catalonia, although to my understanding it was a failure, I think we have to understand why these issues of reproductive rights were solved, developed, in that way at that particular time, and also the very fact that the legislation on abortion in 1936 was more advanced than the present day legislation is also obviously something that's totally relevant. If you deal maybe with other issues, probably the immediacy of the relevancy may not be so obvious. I mean, if you're dealing with the analysis of women in the convents in the medieval ages, maybe the message isn't so direct. But I think the important thing is how you present and try and deal with your historical matters. So I don't think it's just simply a question of, you know, taking the dust off something that anyway, if it stayed in the archive, you know, it wouldn't matter anyway. Maybe that's because, I mean, I spent half my life, well, my whole life actually doing it, so I would like to think that wasn't so. And the other issue you brought up about Portugal, well, to my understanding, again, I don't know whether Anna would agree with me or not, but I think that we have been more directly influenced by books on American or even Italian, French experience. I haven't noticed, at least in Catalonia, this direct impact of the Portuguese experience. There was obviously a very direct political impact when we had the revolution of the Carnations, but the actual gender specificity of that and the development of the feminist Portuguese movement, we did have the publication of the one or two books, but I think it was very incidental. To my mind, the major influences on the development of feminist thought in Spain don't derive from Portugal. I think we, you know, really don't know very much about Portugal. I would say we're more aware.
There was only one book during the revolution called The Three Marias.
The Three Marias, Tres Marias, yes.
That's the main book we read, don't really, I agree with you.
I mean, we know who Betty Friedan is, and we know who Simone de Beauvoir is. These have been the major ones, and it's odd, really. Again, the connections, you know, geographically speaking, don't necessarily mean there's this cultural, immediate cultural transmission. For example, in the field of history, we're probably more aware of what's going on in Italy than in France, you know, which is, again, quite odd, although this is being slowly come over, you know, but...
Mary, I just wanted to point you something about what you say about abortion.
You're a politician, I'm the historian.
No, because I have written about all the legislation, about the first generality. I have a small book with Mary Malek and mine. So, as a historian also, I have done it. And one of the two things I find out is, first of all, not in 1936, but in 1938, exactly the 25th of December. This is also a point of view of the Republicans. They to put abortion law the 25th of December. It's, you know, it has an impact anyway. But the thing I was going to say, that this law was not approved by the parliament, because in 1938 Catalan parliament did not get reunions because the war was on. We were in the middle of the war and the diputates did not go together. So this is not a law. It is what we call a decree law. I'm just saying this because what I feel is that I don't know if they had the discussion, if they could get through on the same as we did. I mean, I'm not going to justify, but well, the thing is that when you are in a moment of war and you have an emergency government, you are not obliged to go to the parliament because the parliament is doing other things, and you can just say this is this and this is this and that's all. Mm-hmm. And one of the main points they put it, it gets very well with that. One of the things they do it was because of what we call healthies, were very afraid during the war to have children malform, and you know that's one of the very big
companies.
That's it. I'm not so sure that they think a lot of women, but anyway, the law was good, and you know it permit you to make what they call a prophylactic abortion. And what they say eugenesic law of abortion. I mean, think that we were in the middle of the war, and the main, they were thinking more than in women's rights in that. They were thinking in that because it was a real difficult situation. I'm not going to say that our law is better or worse than the other one. Just trying to point out the moment it happened.
Yeah, I'd like to join in there. One, I disagree with the dates, but okay. Anyway, that's beside the point. What probably would we have to say at the same time is that the reason, to my mind, one of the many reasons why this law was actually applied at the time was because the anarchists were in power. And Abdi Ibanez was the Director General of the of the Ministry of Health at the time. He was an anarchist. He was an ongoing member of the anarchist Neo-Malthusian movement who had been publishing journals from the 20s and 30s. So it does fit into a whole anarchist policy of self-help, etc. So if that had not been the case, then I quite agree with Anna, we would not have had an abortion law in Catalonia at the time if we didn't have the particular, you know, social change, etc., etc., that was going on at that particular point in time. But anyway.
I think that happened in the First World War in the United States. They didn't pass an abortion law, but they gave condoms to the soldiers.
Exactly,
the same sort of motivation as the one that Anna was talking about. What I wanted to bring up was something that was sort of referred to earlier, was and which refers to something that you said when you talked about the anti-fascist resistance movement as a platform for formation of consciousness, in which you mentioned female consciousness. And I wondered if you could talk about how you see that and why you think it's a useful category, female, as used by Tema Kaplan. I think she's the first person that used that, but I'm not.
Well, when I refer to the organization of women, their mobilization during the Civil War, one of the major, well, let's put it this way, that female organization was basically channeled through female movements. One was the major movement, which was the female anti-fascist movement, and the other would have been the anarchist movement, the free women movement. Now, the major one was the anti-fascist movement, which was an attempt to involve women of different political and non-political coloring within this all-over ongoing struggle. Now, when they actually mobilized, and the discourse involved in the mobilization to a large degree was a very traditional one. For example, the identity membership card of the anti-fascist women's movement spoke on the issue of fascism, addressed the issue of fascism and the consequences it had for women. But it did not do so in direct relation to the woman as a person, but as a mother, or as a wife, in other words, as the function as mother, wife, etc., etc. There is not a direct discourse towards them. When women are mobilized, they are mobilized in supportive roles, relief work. They are mobilized for educational purposes. There is a big educational and professional training drive. But, for example, they are not stated in the terms of the right of women to education per se, but the right of women to education in order to be trained so that she can occupy a post that is being occupied by males. So what I'm saying here basically is that what you have is, and also this is to a large degree assimilated by the women themselves, a development of their consciousness as women, an involvement in the political arena due to their acceptance of their role as nurturers, providers, etc., etc., which obviously comes up with a tension. Because there's a tension on the one hand because the anti-fascist women's movement pushes women into the public arena, but at the same time it's using a very traditional discourse on separation of the spheres, domesticity, etc. So there are particular points in time. I think the time was too short for it to develop as such, but you do get individual expressions of awareness of this certain degree of contradiction. In the sense that you do also, to some degree, it's very difficult to qualify exactly to what degree, find some degree of developing, between commas, feminist awareness. People saying, if we get a job, well, we want to keep on that job. So I think you have, the major focus is on women as nurturers, but from time to time you also, you know, you can glean this sort of more impressionistic evidence that there is an ongoing developing consciousness, be it on the social or political level as well, because it does mean women who would normally have stayed at home being involved in this great anti-fascist movement. And also, to a degree, it affects them as people. I mean, for many women, it was very important to be able to go out on the street, unchaperoned, to be able to actually go to literacy classes. I mean, 45 or 6, I can't remember exactly, percent of women were illiterate in 1936. So it's extremely important for women to do so. And also, we find that within this discourse of women organizing themselves, that it is sometimes a very gender-specific discourse, in the sense that they project themselves in their organization, in their publicizing and publishing of many journals, because there's a great proliferation of women female journals at the time, as a way of showing women's competence. So you have the, you know, female consciousness is not sufficient as a category of analysis for that, but it is useful in certain areas. Feminist consciousness, political social consciousness is also, I think, a useful category, although naturally enough this is against the background probably of a very solid part of the population who simply wants to survive the war, of women who are interested in queuing for bread and actual survival, you know. But I do think in that sense it has been useful to
it really is sort of the organizational and the sort of mobilizational side that is the active ingredient of this, even though the sort of ideology of it is traditional.
Mm-hmm. Quite traditional, yes.
All I'm saying is I'm not sure that it's necessary. I mean, maybe it's necessary to think about it, but when you start really laying it out, I'm not sure that the content, the fact that this has this female, traditional female content, is a good way to label it. I mean, by that term, rather than, you know, the sort of organizational aspect, emphasizing the organizational aspect of it, because that's what you're saying is the important thing, the organizational and change component of it. I'm feeling a little bit inarticulate about it, but being a little bit inarticulate about it, let's say, because I've had this groping feeling, worry about this, when you said it, it sort of triggered it off again. Is it something real, female consciousness, or is it because these women are in organizations that are being paid attention to, listened to, given the opportunity to do something different, that that is the change component, or the salient component?
The thing is, you see, when the war breaks out, there is this spontaneous reaction, which is later channeled.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I do feel that there's this initial involvement by women, initially, but then that gets changed because the development of the organization.
Well, I mean, we can...
Institutionalization of it.
Yeah, just as easily talk about the women that were mentioned before that went to work along with the Falangists, and you could talk about their having come still within
yeah.
what's considered to be the traditional context
yeah.
and for the traditional context, but nevertheless, in terms of their own particular behavior, they were probably to a great degree doing activities that they had not necessarily
yeah.
been asked to do before. And so I think that it is significant to do what's called this analysis of what's the ideology behind the movement, but because what happens later is after the particular catalyst no longer exists, then you have to see where have they come and where will they go with it.
Yeah.
Where will they go with this so-called new formulation of their own consciousness? So, and that's very problematic because
yeah.
what you know, what Tema talks about, the women going out into the street and they went for particular so-called female issues, doesn't necessarily trace what has happened to that consciousness. And although she says, well, they went back and they didn't take everything to its logical conclusion, right? So, and that, you know, that's one of the things that you talk about with well, of course, the anarchist women. That's a whole different ball game. And that was something that I was going to ask about, because I think that's a real area of ignorance. The women that were very much involved in clandestine activity in terms of the Communist Party in Spain are really still remain unknown to us. I mean, Lydia writes one book about it, you know, Es largo
esperar
callado. And then I read this book about this woman, Juana Doña, who wrote about her 20-something years in prison. But apart from that, we have very little. And of course, the area of what was ideology and how was the left, which we know, I mean, the left and the problem of women's work, but what was going on in terms of their own development since this clandestine activity made such demands on their level of consciousness and you know.
Well, there are some studies.
The Communist Party in Catalonia had a magazine called Compagna.
No, this is, you're speaking about after the war?
Yeah.
Sorry.
You were speaking during the war.
After.
And there is no papers at all.
Yeah, right. No, I know that. Nevertheless, but there was activity after the war.
Well, there are some other studies. There's the study by Juliana Di Favo.
Oh, yes.
And also what we are beginning to get now, and I think it's something that should be done, is that is the memoirs. We have already two volumes published by Tomasa Cuevas on her memoirs and also her interviews with women who had been imprisoned with her during the Franco regime. So we are, again, slowly building up. It's very difficult to, I think, actually get a feel of what this actually meant for women themselves, because when you talk to people who were involved, particularly in the clandestine resistance at the time, I think the political issues are so much in their minds that it's actually extremely difficult to get them to talk about everyday things, about how they lived through it. And this, I think, is a major problem. Speaking about the period of the Civil War or speaking about people involved during the resistance to the Franco regime, it's very difficult for them. They give you a political message, basically. And to break down this political message, to actually get them to feel that, one, it's worth talking about, and to get them to understand what you are trying to find out about, I think is very difficult. And most of the sources, like these biographies or these memoirs we have also had this very political focus. So it's not an easy thing to do, because I think these women saw themselves primarily as being involved in a political movement, and they at least were not explicitly aware or don't express or articulate.
They don't express
or articulate this other part of it. And I think in that sense you're quite right. It's, what we have is just partial. It's it's not the complete image, but it's very, very difficult to get at. There are, studies being developed again. We seem to be all saying that we're developing things, but to get, the...